You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of The Music Plays the Band. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I hope you're safe and well. Well, today is a special edition. I am happy to announce that this is my first episode as a member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Nothing changes in how you all will access the podcast, but now we have the power of Pantheon to help us get this out to an even wider audience. Pantheon is the podcast network for music lovers. They have over 70 different podcasts dedicated to all different genres, bands, and angles in the music industry. Anything you can think of, they've got it. Among all their podcasts, there's truly something for everyone. And now that includes the Grateful Dead as well. So I am honored to be a part of their family, and I want to thank them for helping us share our little piece of the Grateful Dead world with all the music lovers out there. You can check out everything they have to offer at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today is also special because we're taking a little bit of a different approach, kind of like we did in the episode where the Brothers Lazaroff interviewed me. Instead of having a musician today, we're going to have author, historian, official biographer, and former publicist for the Grateful Dead, Dennis McNally, on the program. Dennis began as the Grateful Dead's publicist in 1984 and stayed on until 2004, long after the death of Jerry. He was involved in the early offshoots and spent 4 years on the road with Rat Dog as well. He wrote the band's official biography, A Long Strange Trip, along with numerous other books, and is considered the band's official historian. I met Dennis at our first show at the Fillmore in 1999. I had been in the band for about a month, maybe 3 weeks actually, I think. And he was really the first member of the Grateful Dead family that I met. That was actually the first time we met in a professional capacity. But earlier on, in 1990, when I guess I was 22 years old, and was on a Grateful Dead tour in Europe, and it was the second day of the London shows, and Mickey Hart was doing a book signing for Drumming at the Edge of Magic at a bookstore somewhere in London. So I woke up super early and super beat up from the show the night before, and traipsed across London and was the first person in line, total fanboy, getting to meet Mickey Hart. And got in line, bought the book, had it signed, and got back in line to ask another question. And Mickey said, "You again?" I said, "Yeah, I got lots of questions." He goes, "Go stand over there with that guy and just wait." So I went over there, and it was Dennis McNally, who I obviously did not know. And I stood against the wall with him at the bookstore, and we just chatted. I don't really remember what about. But he hung out with me until the book signing was over, and then sure enough, Mickey came over and spent a few minutes with me, and answered some questions before they got in the van to take off. Got a nice picture together. He wrote "To Rob, Drum On" in my copy of the book, which I still have. So that was pretty cool. Over the years, we've stayed in touch with him and his wife, Susanna Millman, who's a fantastic photographer. And I was so thrilled he agreed to come on with me today. So much to talk about, so little time. We could probably do hours and hours with Dennis. But I'm really happy to have him for the time we do. So once again, I'd like to thank Pantheon for welcoming me into their family. And before we get to the conversation, I humbly ask you to support the podcast in any way you can. There's the monthly Patreon subscription with giving levels starting as low as $5 a month. With a Patreon subscription, you get exclusive bonus content, including outtakes, of which there are quite a few from my conversation with Dennis, expanded interviews and segments, videos and stories from the road, and much, much more. You can also make a one-time contribution through PayPal, and a portion of all the proceeds go to the Rex Foundation, the charity started by the Grateful Dead. You can find out all about this and more at www.themusicplaystheband.net. And wherever you're listening to the podcast, please rate, like, and review. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dennis McNally. Okay, so I am here today with Grateful Dead's former publicist, biographer, historian, Dennis McNally. How are you today, my friend?
I'm all right. How's yourself?
I'm doing great. Again, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I know you are so, so busy. And so much to talk about. But first, why don't we catch up real quick on how'd you spend this crazy pandemic time? What's kept you busy?
Oh, God. Well, I was writing a book, which will keep you busy no matter what the time, have a first draft of that, second draft, actually. My commute is from my bed to my desks, which is to say that in many ways, the pandemic had a very limited effect on, you know, outside of looking at the world melting down. It had a limited effect on my daily thing. And fortunately, since musicians couldn't tour, obviously that, you know, there were a couple of tours that I would have worked on that got canceled. But since musicians couldn't tour, they put out CDs. And I actually, the last 2 months, I've been the busiest I've been in 15 years.
That's a great problem to have.
Great. It was the preferable problem, although it just was. But anyway, it's, I'm starting to come down off that particular circus. So right, I'm grateful.
Well, you've worked with so many different bands and you've written numerous books on multiple subjects. But today we're going to stick primarily with the Grateful Dead. And I want to start right at the beginning for you. Do you recall, when is the first time you heard the Grateful Dead, that you got turned on to this music?
In the fall of 1967, I was a freshman in college. And I went to work, or volunteered at the campus radio station. And I came across what was then a 6 months old brand new album, The First, from the Grateful Dead. And I loved it, especially Morning Dew. And played it a lot. But then, for whatever reason, I somehow missed Anthem and Oxmox. So I just sort of, and so when I really fell into the soup was in the fall of 71, I went away to graduate school and hooked this one good buddy. Long story short, in early 1972, I was sitting around talking about working on a book and he a dissertation, and he said, "You should do Kerouac. His papers are at Columbia, and my buddies, you can stay with my friends in the Bronx," which kind of is exactly what happened. And so that was in February, and got really started in the summer. And then that fall, October 2nd, the Dead came to Springfield, Massachusetts. In addition to telling me to work on Kerouac, this guy was a Deadhead. We did nothing but listen to records. This is before tapes. We're old. Right. we listened to Grateful Dead records with the single exception of Hot Tuna. He took me to my first show and told me to open my mouth and drop something in. And that was my introduction to the Grateful Dead.
What was it? What was it about this music that just pulled you in, besides whatever you opened your mouth for? But what about the music physically pulled you in?
Well, the best part of being a Deadhead for me, I, in particular, at the beginning, when it was really unfamiliar, was when they would jam from a song to a song, and I would suddenly sort of look up and realize, oh, they've been playing that new song now for like the last 3 minutes. But I never witnessed the transition because, you know, it was all new to me. And to some extent, that's all, you know, that's that sort of the space between songs is just, you know, endlessly fascinating. When you don't know what's coming, there's a show which I'm sure you're familiar with, at the Miami High Life Fronton in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember all the details. I don't even know what song they started with, but they started with a song and they just sort of went out into outer space for 20 minutes. And they, what I called, signaled at least three songs. I could hear them considering going into that song. Now maybe we'll do it later, at three different times. And then they proceeded to play those three songs. And that's sort of one of my, I mean, that's sort of what they did. What I discovered was that instead of being a show, I'm telling you this, but anyway, you want me to say this stuff. Instead of being a show, what you got at a Grateful Dead concert was kind of a reading of the collective mind of the people on stage, and how they were feeling that night. I remember having a long conversation with Garcia about, well, the first lesson I learned when I was around, got to be around the band, the first lesson I learned was never rush up to a band member after a show and say, "That was great," you know, because he'll look at you and go, "Are you kidding me? Did you hear what fill in the blank, how he was playing? And I sucked," and da-da-da. And the point being that there are also shows where I knew they were going to come on the stage going, "God, that was," and I'm going, "I don't care what you said, that was brilliant." You know, the point is, Jerry admitted many times, he was the worst guide to whether or not it was a good show, quite often. Maybe his feet hurt, maybe, you know, whatever. And the point was that all he could do was, you know, play the best he could, let it go, and, you know, maybe tomorrow will be better. The classic example, as he told the story, was of losing it on Lesh, which did not happen very often, and like shoving him actually down the stairs at the Fillmore West, to because it was just, he was like so frustrated. And then they ended up using music from that night in Anthem of the Sun.
Right.
So, you know, he kind of realized that he's not in the best position to evaluate it. You know, he might think it's going great and it actually sounds very flat to the audience, or sure, vice versa.
So much of that is experiential, even as a fan. I mean, we would be at shows and think that was the greatest show ever. And then you go back and listen to the tape. That really wasn't that good of a show. But in that moment where I was, that was the greatest thing I had ever heard.
I met one of my closest Deadhead friends. I met on the bus to a show in Sacramento from San Francisco, and in the summer of 79. And we both have tended to agree that it's in the ranking for worst show ever. Certainly it's in the running. It was flat, dull. They just, you know, they were still integrating Brent, and it just wasn't, it did not pick up. But I remember my friend, Danny is his name, Danny saying, something to the effect of, "Well, I'll have to hear the tape, but," and I went, "Yeah, yes, yes, on both counts, but I'm predicting," and this was as we were leaving the show, I'm predicting what you know, "God, what was that about?" So,
right.
You know, and that's the deal of being a Deadhead, is of course that there's a high degree of variability. There's the occasional great show. There's many, many, many very high grade shows. And then there's, you know, and then there's the occasional catastrophic.
Sure. Well, that's the experience really now with any improvisational band.
That's because
you're going exactly for it, and it's not always going to work.
No. David Freiberg's the bass player for Quicksilver and whatnot, said that what he loved about the Grateful Dead was that he loved watching musicians jump off a cliff. And, you know, sometimes you fly, and a lot of the times you end up on the rocks, and, you know, but in that risk, there's the opportunity for something very special.
Right, right. So throughout the 70s, then you're still working on the Kerouac biography, and are you going to a good amount of shows? I mean, you're a Grateful Dead fan at this point.
I'm certainly a Grateful Dead fan. This is, again, this is the 70s, not the 80s. So you know, people did not generally go to follow tours, for instance. That really was something that happened in the 80s. And I was a graduate student. I had no money. So as a result, through the 70s, I went to the shows that they played in, you know, my immediate neighborhood. And there were some, you know, really terrific shows. There's a kind of legendary show. Actually, I wrote the liner notes in March of, I think it was March 30th, but don't hold me to that. 1973 in Springfield. It was the day after Garcia had gotten busted in New Jersey. We're driving on the New Jersey Turnpike. And, you know, we woke up in the morning reading the paper thinking, I wonder if we're going to have a show. And of course, you know, it's like you bail. Jerry wasn't exactly going to worry about a pot bust. Which was a wonderful show. And then in 74, I got the wonderful privilege in June of 74 of seeing The Wall of Sound, which indoors, Springfield Civic Center is about 7,000 capacity, which is to say, you know, it's not an NBA arena. It's relatively small. And you walk in, when you walk through the lobby, you walk in, you're at the rear of the hall. And I swear to God, it looked like a spaceship ready to lift off or something. It was pretty indoors. It just about scraped the ceiling. And indoors, it was just fabulous.
That's awesome.
And I might add, the first set, they did I've never heard it since. I don't know why, I've never organized that. They did Playing in the Band and Uncle Jan's Band back into Playing in the Band. It was like 45 minutes to end the first set. And we were on our knees at intermission. We were simply on our knees. It was some of the best music I ever heard them play live.
Wow.
With me in the room. Remarkable.
So I had a little while back, we had a Rick Turner on talking about The Wall and the whole genesis of it, did some wonderful conversations with him. So how did you end up taking that next step from fan to employee to confidant?
Well, it was a combination of, I used to say that that I knew that the only, okay. So I started the Kerouac book in 72, finished by about 74. I realized that there were a lot of connections between the beat scene and Kerouac and Neil Cassidy, of course, and the Grateful Dead. And I wanted to do a second book about the Grateful Dead, but I also knew I didn't have any phone numbers. I didn't have any connections. So anyway, I finished the first draft of the Kerouac book, moved out to the Bay Area to live because I had seen San Francisco. A research trip had taken me to San Francisco and I fell in love with the city, said, here I stay. And a couple of years later, here I stay. And I've been here now more than 40 years. And part of that, of course, was the appeal. Part of the appeal, of course, was that, you know, I was closer to them and in particular to lots of shows. So that was in 76. Finally, my Kerouac book was published in 79, and I sent a copy to Jerry and a copy to Hunter at the Deadhead mailing address, Post Office Box 1065. San Rafael. And very long. So now I'm plotting and scheming. How do I get next to the Grateful Dead? So I went and pitched an article in the fall of 79. I pitched an article to the San Francisco Chronicle's Sunday magazine and said, you know, you should do an article about the Grateful Dead at New Year's. And they went, yeah, great idea. Okay, go. So at New Year's 12/31/79, Bill Graham was a butterfly. I was sick as a dog, but I had to go to the show. And again, long story short, the article, so it was a long article, and the editor said, I don't want to cut this article. But we need to sell lots of ads and have a fat issue to put you in. So just wait. So in August of 1980, now it is, there's an advertisement in the San Francisco Chronicle. The entertainment section is called the pink section, the pink. And there was a big ad, and it was two skeletons crowned in roses with their elbows. They're as tall as, and it's this cartoon, I guess you could say, of the Warfield Theater. And the caption is, they're not the best at what they do. They're the only ones who do what they do. No mention of the band's name in this ad. And it listed 13 shows. So I, in addition to, see what had happened, the inside story on this is in June of 80, they played two shows at Folsom Field in Boulder. And on the tickets, it said that it was the celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Grateful Dead, which at the time seemed like quite an anniversary, right? 15 years. Well, that's long. And they played a normal show. And as they're going back to the hotel, basically they're saying, that's weird, you know? I mean, the response to the show was like really, really dull. And the Rock Scully, I think it was Rock, says to them, Rock Scully was then theoretically the publicist, I guess. And he says to them, well, yeah, that's because the audience was expecting something special. It's the 15th anniversary. And the band said, what? So the next day, they did a little, they opened with, some second set material, to open the show. And then they started, plotting. Very Grateful Dead, management not telling the band, the promoter, anyway. So the result was to celebrate the 15th anniversary, they did the run in San Francisco, and then a couple in New Orleans, and then the run at Radio City. And in order to fill, because they were going to do an acoustic set and then two electric sets, that's two intermissions. So they brought in Franken and Davis to do some skits for the Halloween show, this is even before widespread cable. This is how far back this goes. They set up a closed circuit TV thing or video with about 10 movie theaters up and down the East Coast and broadcast that on, Halloween. And in the process of making that video, more detail than probably we have time for, Jerry met with some deadheads as a way of collecting stories about, road adventures. And I got into that meeting, again, long story short, and mentioned the Kerouac book, and he got very excited. Now, I am proud of the book, and I thought I did a decent job. But the fact was that Kerouac was Jerry's avatar, his role model from the time he was 16. He was this, young wannabe art student in North Beach who got turned onto guitar specifically by that teacher, the teacher of that art class, a guy named Wally Hedrick, who's actually I'm now writing a book about that includes very significantly Wally Hedrick. So that's another story. And Wally sent him down to City Lights and said, go read this book On the Road, which was like on the bestseller list then. It was like current. And that was it. Jerry was a beat, Jerry always thought of himself as a late stage beatnik. He was not a hippie in that regard. Followed that. So when he got my book and decided that, well, yeah, this guy knows, as he said, my prejudices confirmed his. He liked it. And long story short, a couple of months later, he sent a couple of guys to me, and they said, Jerry says, why don't you do us? why don't you write a book about the Grateful Dead?
Wow.
Which, of course, I've been dreaming about for 7 years. And I managed to maintain my cool at that moment and just say, well, gee, you know, sounds like a good idea. Let me give that some thought. And then I went home, got seriously plastered, and, you know, and the rest was, you know, history. So I did that. I was working on the book for 3 years. And what I didn't realize at the time was that I was sort of slowly being pledged to the it's not a fraternity, because it was, we used to call them frororities, which is to say, men and women, the family of the Grateful Dead. And I didn't piss off anybody too much. So in 1984, there was a band meeting, which is an all company meeting, in which the receptionist said, well, Rock had finally gone off for a vacation and some rehab because he needed to. And nobody was dealing with the press. The manager didn't like the press and was too busy anyway. One manager, you know, Grateful Dead were unmanageable for starters. And so Jerry said, get McNally to do it. He knows that shit.
Did you know that shit?
Well, I had done a book tour. So I knew that a publicist called the media, you know, members of the media, and said, say something nice about my client. And frankly, I've now been doing this for 41 years, almost no, 35 years, and I haven't learned a friggin' thing since. I mean, the technology changes, but the answer, you know, and you know, there's now social media, which I leave to smarter people than myself. But the fact is that being a publicist, it's not rocket science, and it's mostly a matter of relationships, which, of course, I came in at the top. You know, I mean, most people start out repping a band. You know, poor Dave Wiseman starting, you know, when he started, you guys are doing relatively small business, and
right,
et cetera, you know, and you know, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
So you start this, I mean, you come in as a biographer, you end up, you get elevated, if you want to call it that, to publicist. Is this just completely surreal for you? Or is this just, hey, put my head down, I've got a job to do, forgetting about this, the band I've been a fan of all this time?
By then, you know, I knew them well enough as people that I wasn't like giddy with, oh my God. I mean, having a paycheck was really nice.
Right.
And at the moment I needed work. And at that moment I was getting what the people in the office got, which was more than I'd ever made before. Still not deluxe, it was a living. And for about 6 months I tried to do both.
Right. And that's not possible.
After about simultaneously. And then, you know, not to whine, because it was the best job of a lifetime. But you worked when you worked for the Grateful Dead.
Right.
Okay. So here's the ultimate one-liner about Grateful Dead and work. We were in Washington, D.C., and it was a typically god-awful 100 degrees, 100% humidity at RFK Stadium. And we were coming off the stage, I and Ramrod, who was the Grateful Dead's crew chief and one of the best men I've ever met in my life. We got to the top of the stairs, and, you know, we'd been outside 12 hours in miserable conditions. And Ramrod said, well, at least it's not a real job.
Right.
And that's true. We weren't working for a corporation. It had so much, there was craziness and drama and adventure and all kinds of stuff. And we all knew that, again, it was a lot more than just a job.
I call that, when people ask me about that, I call it, yes, it's the hardest, easy job in the world.
There you go. And people, when I came after a couple of months of being an employee, I came to a band meeting. And I said, listen, you know, you should take me out on the road. And one of the crew members said, we've already sold the tickets. What do we need you for? And I said, because the media interest has reached the point by the middle 80s, in addition to just being the only sort of weird act around and the last remaining, the last man standing, so-called, from San Francisco, the fact was that by now in the middle 80s, the people of my generation, which is to say I was then 35, the second wave, okay, so there are lots of waves of deadheads. The first wave was the San Franciscans. The second wave were the East Coast college kids. That'd be me and my peers. And by now in the middle 80s, they're making decisions at newspapers and TV, and they want to cover the Grateful Dead because they love the Grateful Dead, and they want to do it positively. However, they're going to cover it. And if they can't get in, then they're going to cover the parking lot, which, you know, you can make it look good, you can make it look bad.
How hard is that job for you when you have a band that essentially really doesn't want to deal with the media, if I'm right?
Well, that was the point. It was an easy job in that way because it meant I didn't have anybody supervising me. What I had to do was get the media, in particular TV cameras and still cameras, in and out with as little interaction with, zero interaction with band members or crew as humanly possible. Fortunately, Dan Healy was, more than cooperative. And so what he and Ultrasound made a sound feed available to me for them, for the TV, out at the soundboard. So I meet the TV and walk them into the soundboard and get them set up, and they would get, good sound and, the pretty lights and they, they were happy. And I'd give them some talk if they wanted to talk to somebody. So, it worked out fine. Now, there were times when I said, when somebody would look at me and go, "Did you do anything tonight?" I said, "Well, we had 5 TV crews and 6 photographers, and you never saw them, did you?" And they went, "No."
Nice job, Dennis.
I said, "Well, then I did a really good show."
as it goes on, and when In the Dark comes out and everything just blows up, does everything change for you and the job? Does it just get that much more monumental?
It just got hard. I mean, it got harder. Pretty much from 88 on, any show that we didn't have some kind of weirdness or disaster, was it like a triumph? I remember we had this great show in LA. We pulled everything off. It was all good. And I'm not even going to go into it, but there was a particularly horrible story after with a deadhead who did way, way too much and got in a car and ended up killing somebody. It was like, are we responsible for that person? Well, maybe we are. I don't, but whatever.
Regardless of whether you're responsible, you're still going to have to tackle the issue.
The issue is going to come up. And, obviously what happened just in Houston is something that's on my mind. There are people I suspect that I know, from Live Nation who are going to answer questions about it too, not just the act. There are ways to make sure that, among other things, you don't have people. I mean, you will remember Bob Weir playing the Step Back song when there were, when the people in the front row were starting to get squoze at a Grateful Dead. It happened, not violently the way, it happened in Houston with people just, careening. And you'd have to say, okay, we're not going to play until everybody from the front row to the last takes 3 steps back. And then now why don't you take 3 more?
And take another step back.
And take another. And eventually, when things calmed down, then it was like we played. And so we never had that kind of, we never had a major problem inside. There's a lot of complexities to being a band, particularly when you're a successful band and you have large audiences. And one of them is that you're kind of responsible for your audience, and there are things you have to think about. You can't just do it on the fly. And there have been the legendary, you know, when the Who, the Who in Cincinnati,
right,
where there was a crush and there was no setup to where people couldn't just try and cram through the door. That's why you get those setups where, you know, you sort of go through a little white rat psycho test maze to get to the front door. Well, there's a reason for that. And what happened, of course, was that the Who did a sound check and the people in front thought it was the start of the show.
The doors open and boom.
And they,
right through the glass.
People died. And that's, you know, that's the promoter's fault.
Right. As that's blowing up and there's all these new media demands, does that have an effect on the guys in the band, or are you doing such a good job of shielding them from it? They don't even notice what's going on, that they're getting so big now.
They certainly knew they were getting that big, because I was at a meeting in December of 85 in the lobby of Front Street, which is where the important band meetings actually took place. And basically Jerry said, well, you know, and this was not done with like, yeah, you know, we're going to have to play stadiums next summer. Not quite big enough to play full stadiums, but we can't function with the venues in the summer when there's, you know, people are out of school and whatnot. And so the discussion was, well, who do we tour with? And of course there was one obvious answer, which was Dylan. So we did that first tour with Dylan, backed by Tom Petty. And then of course they made the huge mistake of having a hit and it just went. So for the band, they were already used to full houses. I don't know, you'd have to ask the band how much it affected them with the various stuff. We being Cameron, in particular, Cameron Sears, who was the tour manager, and I, as the publicist, were did our very best to shield them from, you know, say the fact that 30 people got arrested, unless they asked, you know, you give them the truth. But I'll give you an example. It's a very funny scene. We were in Memphis for the first time in forever, 95.
Right? At the Pyramid. I was there.
And I'm with like every TV crew in the Memphis area. You know, it was a big deal. And outside, people are trying to sneak in. A lot of people are trying to sneak in. Now, the Memphis cops were much like the New Orleans cops, which is to say, it's a party town, you know, whether it's Beale Street or Bourbon Street. And they were actually very tolerant, incredibly tolerant. They were grabbing people, you know, throwing them back, as it were, but nobody was getting beat up and nobody was getting arrested. So I get this radio call from our head of security saying, because, I mean, it's a mess out there. It's not quite a riot, but because, as I say, the cops, if the cops had wanted to make a riot, they could have. You know, there was enough mishigas going on. But so I get our security guy says, listen, you know, it's really a mess out here. We do not really need the TV cameras to see this. Why don't you keep them? So I said, guys, take a couple extra songs. What the hell? And, you know, nobody wanted to leave. They were having a good time. And so I sort of kept them trapped at the soundboard for an extra 20 minutes, by which time everything had cleared and calmed down and they could go back to the stations without filming what looked like worse than it was. Because as I say, the sheer experience of the Beale Streets and the Bourbon Streets, and where you have police that are used to a bunch of drunks, so that excited college kids is actually kind of easy to deal with by comparison.
Right. As your tenure goes on, you become more than just an employee. You cultivate personal relationships with the band. I know that Billy was your best man and Jerry walked Susanna down the aisle at your wedding. Is there a fine line? Is there a tightrope that you have to balance between the personal and the business, or is it all just flow seamlessly together?
No, I wouldn't say it's seamless. I know that when Susanna said to me, I want Jerry to walk me down the aisle because her father had passed when she was a wee one. And her other, you know, her alternate father, a lovely man, but he was traveling, I don't know, the far reaches of the planet. He went to over 100 countries, so he was somewhere. Wow. So Susanna said, you know, I think I'm going to ask Jerry. And I said, you're his friend. You can. I can't. I am, as an employee, that would be really inappropriate for me to do that. And so she asked him, and then he said to me, he said, I'm perfectly willing to do it, but I got to warn you, none of the weddings I've ever been part of have ever, the relationships never went too well. I said, yeah, well, we'll take the chance. And that was 36 years ago, so, or seven, 30, whatever. So the answer is that, you know, so in 86, you know, when Jerry went down with the
coma,
diabetic coma, yeah. I got laid off. I was the only person laid off because I was the new guy. And frankly, Phil and Mickey were like nervous about life at that moment and wanted to prove that, you know, they were in control of the situation. So they laid me off. In 92, when Jerry was ill and we had to skip a tour, instead of being laid off, I got called into the room and asked for advice. And I reflected later. So I was like, you've been around long enough now. And I dealt with Brent and, you know, stuff. And then, you know, when Jerry died, the band was all sitting in the office, and I had a press conference out in the parking lot of the office, and I walked in and basically said, anybody want to come with me? And they went, oh, no, you can handle it. It's fine. Nobody was thrilled about having to do that. So.
Right, heavy.
So, yeah, bit by bit, my relationship, you know, certainly did get deeper and thicker and whatnot.
When, you know, you're on the road and you're doing that, it's grueling to be on the road at any level, but especially at the level where you're in stadiums and all that. And you have to be a fan of the music or it would probably get to the point of being unbearable. But what I want to know is, did you ever get to a minute or a second, a set, to just stop and enjoy the music and the scene and really take stock of where you were? Or was it just, I mean, you were a fan of this music. Did you ever get to stop and enjoy it?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, it was the greatest job in the world because I was usually free for the second set. You know, I mean, I'd be listening to the radio at the end of, you know, we had walkie talkies to, you know, in case somebody needed me and whatnot. I had to make certain, you know, circuits to, you know, just make, to stay on top of things. But no, I got my fair share of the second set. And I gotta say, the Grateful Dead, remember, the hard part, I don't need to tell you, the hard part of touring is the travel. It's not the playing, it's
the other 20 hours of the day.
And the thing about the Grateful Dead is, A, okay, show ends, band comes off the stage, the food guys are standing there with shopping bags full of whatever they've ordered to take home, to take with them, which could go from peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, which is what Phil Lesh would order, which was like, you could order anything and you PB&J, to, you know, full meals. The vans would be lined up waiting. You hop in the van, you go 20 minutes. It was always 20 minutes. Don't ask. Somehow there's an airport 20 minutes from every venue. That's not literally true, but close enough. You go drive out on the tarmac. It's almost always a private airport, or at least the private area of a big airport. Mm-hmm. You walk up the stairs onto the plane. You fly an hour, reverse the process, and about 2 hours, roughly, after the show, when people are still straggling out of the parking lot, we're in our room.
In the next town.
And it's usually a day off. Usually right. we had just done three at that town where, you know, sometimes in the stadiums it was, suffice it to say, and we're talking, we're not talking about flea bags. We're talking about five-star hotels. And so it was, they had figured out at least how to minimize the, you know, the travel damage. So you didn't go into airports if you could humanly help it, because dealing with the people, you know, that gets a little harder.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. I heard, and you'll be able to correct me if I'm wrong, I heard that on a business level, if everybody wasn't on board with something, it wouldn't happen.
True.
Were there opportunities that got passed on where you were billions. Saying, God, we really should be doing this?
Well, you know, the point is, how do you measure an opportunity? And the opportunities were generally financial. And, you know, the Grateful Dead was, generally speaking, not greedy. So that, you know, people were making more money than they ever dreamed of making, and still doing exactly what they'd always done, which is just to play their music. As you say, it was a one loud no within the band. One loud no was a veto. It was a very conservative democracy, conservative in the sense that it was very difficult. You know, now that meant that if everybody agreed, then you actually got things done. But it was somebody would want to, whether it was an obscure show or more likely some video or commercials, sell the music through,
right.
I still, to this day, have a sore jaw from it dropping when I saw Bob Dylan selling his music to, what was the underwear company? Women's underwear.
Not Hanes.
Something very chic. Whatever it was. Or maybe it was, maybe even it was perfume. I don't know. Whatever it was unlikely. And it was just like, do you really need the money? I mean,
right.
What?
Wow. After Jerry passes in 95, you stayed on until GDP shut its doors in 2004. What are those first couple of years like? What's the adjustment?
Well, you know, we were all grieving. I mean, you know, so you've got the people I work with, which is in particular the office staff. And we're trying to communicate with Deadheads. And I mean, whether it was naive and slightly romantic, but I thought of myself as trying to hold the whole thing together in terms of giving information to Deadheads and relating to them as people and encouraging them. And, you know, I had no clue about what was going to come.
Right.
So I finished, you know, eventually I went on halftime and wrote and finished the book. It's finally time to do that. And put it out in 2002. And then in 2004, production company was folded. And I went to work for Bobby for 4 years. Because so this is 2004, so now Jerry's been dead 9 years. Bobby does not like necessarily talk about emotional things very well because whoever, you know, whoever he is. But the way you can observe his grieving, for example, was his basic refusal to play Grateful Dead material for 10 years.
Right, right.
And he had the art band, that is to say, Rob Wasserman, who's not an improvisational bass player, he's a brilliant bass player, but he was an art bass player. They had that original version of Rat Dog, you know, with either Johnny or so. Anyway, and so what happened was in early 2004, I guess it was. I was doing a PR tour for a record that Bobby put out of, I think it was Best Hits. I don't know, or maybe it was an early Rat Dog record, and. Saw the band, the new Rat Dog, which included Robin Sylvester, in New Jersey at the Performing Arts Center there. And I was standing next to John Scheer, who was then Bobby's co-manager. And in the middle of this, because they were jamming, and I was like, oh, been missing this for the last 9 years. And I turned to him, I said, I want in, I want to go back on the road, bus and all. And because this band can grow. Whereas I didn't think that was the case with the earlier band, which was designed not to open up. It was designed to be
a blues band, essentially, with Johnny on keyboards and all that. Sure.
Yeah. And it was a good blues band, but, you know, so so the 4 years of Rat Dog to OA was, you know, was great. And then Bobby went with Phil to do Further. And that didn't include either Bobby's management or me. I was sort of junior management.
If we go back for a minute, but go back into the 90s when GDP's still there and you got the Further festivals and the other ones and the Dead, all these different offshoots, and you're still part of that. How hard is that emotionally? Is it's still, the wound is still fresh, if you will, still open. How hard is it emotionally for you to go out there and do all this without Garcia being a part of it? And here we are again, though.
You know, I felt that more when I saw Dead & Company, which I respect greatly as a band. But the first time I went to see Dead & Company at Shoreline, it was like, where is he? Maybe because it was at Shoreline and I wasn't working. You know, I didn't have my normal role scurrying around and pretending I was working. I do remember, and I, whether it was the Dead or the, I think it was the other ones. I can't even remember the name.
Right.
But we started the tour and I later wrote a press release, which was that I called it the Who Knew Tour, because nobody knew what it was going to be like to try and play Grateful Dead music. I think we had, I cannot remember who was and wasn't on that particular tour. But the spark was clearly, you know, by the second show, I think we knew, whoa, okay, we're back. And I was so proud of that, and so proud of them carrying on that. It wasn't, you know, I mean, I miss Jerry. I still do. I still have occasional, not frequent, but occasional dreams where he pops up and says something.
I think the fact that it was still there, like you said, it's still there, is really, I mean, of course, nothing to denigrate Jerry. It's a testament to the songs.
Oh, absolutely. Well, so here's the real deal and where we're at now in 2021, which is I knew, frankly, even, and I did not have, was not privy to any inside gossip. I wasn't working with any of the band members, friendly with them, but not working with them. And I knew that there was going to be a fare-thee-well. There simply had to be. There was too much psychic momentum and, bluntly, too much money. So what I had no clue about, and what I did not realize until maybe a year later, and the year which you are part of, which was that in saying goodbye to the Grateful Dead, as it was constituted at Fare-Thee-Well, Deadhead said, yeah, we love these guys, you know, but the fact is that what we really love is the music. And it's almost a matter of taste, whether you like Dark Star's version or J-Rad's version, or, you know, you name it, O'Teal's it's a Dead & Company's version.
Right.
And in fact, that Fare-Thee-Well simply reignited the whole shtick. I never saw that coming. I assumed that being a Deadhead would sort of dwindle away, because all things dwindle away, except apparently being a Deadhead.
And the fact that the fan base is getting older and older and older, but now new fans are coming in.
But now you go to any one of your shows, J-Rad show, the audience looks the same as it did 50 years ago. you know, demographically and age-wise.
I attribute that to cool songs and cool parents.
All that. Yeah. And you know, the Bruce Hornsby called Grateful Dead songs hymns. And you know, some of them really are, you know, Ripple really is. But the fact is that the body of the work is astonishing. And, you know, there are going to be people listening to Dark Star 100 years from now. And think about that. I actually listen to music that's 100 years old. I listen to music from the early 20s, recorded then. Sounds by current standards awful, but there's not much that, and not many people listen to music that's that old. But it will endure because it has that secret ingredient of improvisation, so that sometimes it'll be great and sometimes it won't. But the openness to possibility is something not everybody wants to hear. That, you know, you can describe that as noodling, as many have, but there obviously are people for whom, yeah, that's the way to fly.
I want to ask you then, and we're running out of time, and I had a couple others, but I'm going to go to this question because it's a broad one, but it segues right from that, and it's a big one here. But you know, you're a gentleman who has a doctorate in history, and you've studied and you've documented and you've been a part of the Grateful Dead's journey. The question is, where do you, as a person who's been there with all that, where do you see their place in the history of American music?
I think they're the greatest rock jazz fusion band that ever played. And that includes their opening act, Miles Davis, and the Bitches Brew Band.
Right.
Which they were appropriately embarrassed at having Miles open for them, but you know, he didn't seem to mind. They you know, whereas with another band, he refused to have somebody, you know, he refused to open for them and made them go first. The point is, it's unique. You start with the original band. And you've got, you know, a banjo player applying bluegrass style single point notes to the guitar, which nobody was doing at the time, really. I mean, they've limited little blues runs, but you know what, where he went, you know, it was, you know, applying John Coltrane to the guitar. You've got, you know, a folky, you've got an R&B drummer. Later, you have a guy who started out as a marching band drummer. I don't know, sometimes you've seen this, but I urge people sometimes, just look at the way Mickey and Billy sit. Billy sort of slumps and is very relaxed. And to this day, Mickey's still got his Air Force, you know. I mean, that guy's got the straightest spine on the planet. And it's fascinating, you know, that contrast. So anyway, you've got guys coming from, you know, Phil as the trumpet player, Stockhausen fan. And, you know, everybody was coming from a different place, and they melted together through improvisation and LSD, frankly, and that experience, and came up with something completely unique.
And that music,
and it'll endure.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And this music's going to live on forever. It's been so well documented over the years. There's people playing it. There's a cover band in every town who keeps it alive for the locals. And it, I mean,
five cover bands in every town. It's amazing.
Yep. I do a segment about that on the podcast too. I interview a different cover band every episode just to hear about their community and how they interpret the music.
And, you know, which is why, you know, the next time I will see you face to face in April, that's what, how Skull and Roses could even exist, right, is because the idea of bringing 25 different bands playing Grateful Dead music into one spot might have sounded weird once upon a time, but now it makes total sense.
Yeah, there's so many different ways. It's become it's like the Great American Songbook. It's like the real book. You know, it's here's a set of standards. We have musicians who know how to play it. Now let's listen to how they interpret it.
Exactly. You know, right. And everybody does it a little differently. And I have been, as part of my work with Skull and Roses, you know, I've talked with endless different musicians about how they approach it. And it's like a musical Rorschach test.
Yes, I love it. Well, Dennis, I cannot thank you enough. I know you got to get moving on to your next project today, but I seriously, thank you so much for taking the time with me. I've really, really enjoyed this.
Anytime.
And I look forward to seeing you again. We'll see you in April. That's right.
We will see you in April, and then you get to work.
That's right. That's not work, man.
Yeah, that's what they call it, playing.
That's right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is Dennis McNally, who spent his morning with us. Thank you so much, my friend.
You're welcome.
That was so great. I enjoyed that as much as anything I've done up to this point. And that also will bring us to the end of another episode. And I'd again like to thank Dennis McNally for taking the time to help make this a really special edition. Once again, I'd like to thank the Pantheon Podcast Network for inviting me into their family. I'm so excited to bring this podcast and knowledge of the Grateful Dead to an even wider audience. So looking forward to being here for a long time to come. If you enjoyed the show and would like to support the cause, please consider a monthly Patreon subscription that offers some great bonus content every week, or you can show your love with a one-time contribution, and please remember that a portion of your contribution will go to the Rex Foundation. Get info about this and everything related to the podcast at our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. Any love is much appreciated as we try and keep the show rolling and growing. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com, and they have a really cool gig coming up on December 4th called the Hanukkah Hullabaloo. It's an annual gig they do here in St. Louis that's really, really cool, so go to their website and check out what it's all about. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English, and he should be putting out an album of this stuff any day now. I will keep you posted for sure. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode number 24 featuring Al Schneer, guitar player from Mo. And until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant. We really need things to keep trending in the right direction, so take care of yourselves, and just as importantly, think about taking care of all of those around you. Thanks for being here.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.